Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for joining me and listening wherever you may be around the world. And today, it's a very special deep dive episode with Andrea Stewart, the author of the Drowning Kingdom trilogy, a completed trilogy at that, and one I just released as one of my top 10 all-time favorite series of all time. Andrea, thank you so much for joining me, and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been such a joy of a series to read, with the final book being released earlier this year. In retrospect, looking back from beginning to end, can you just tell us a little bit about like the experience, how like the inspiration for this series started, and the completion of the final chapter in this saga?
Yeah, sure. So I actually got the inspiration for the series a really long time before I started writing it. I've told the story so many times, but I was out for lunch with some author friends, and one of them almost choked on a piece of bone while she was eating lunch. And so I started thinking like, well, what if I used bone shards for magic? And there were other things that I knew I wanted to put into the books. Like I knew I wanted to have constructs, and I knew I wanted to have this palace of locked doors. So I kind of started putting all that stuff together, and that's how it all began. So I started writing like little snippets of it a little bit after that, but I didn't really start writing the whole series until years later. And at that time I had already had other books, you know, go out on submission to editors and die. So I wasn't expecting much with this just because it had been such a long road to publication. But I was really glad when Orbit picked it up for 3 books. And I had written like a little bit about what happens in books 2 and books 3. So I knew from, you know, that time that we sent that book 1 out, what was going to happen and how it was going to end. I did go back and look at those recently, and it actually sticks really close to what I had originally envisioned. And finishing that last book, it's, you know, it's been quite a journey. It's like one of those things where you're like, I'm a little bit sad to leave the world and to leave the characters behind. But at the same time, you know, I'm really excited to be working on something new too, because it has been a long time spent in one world on one series with one set of characters.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And after completing like the final chapter and just the twists that you have throughout the series, I was wondering how hard it was to keep it close to the chest when writing these out, not to give too much away too soon. Because that's why I love these books, the twists that you bring through them and the riveting plot involved.
Oh gosh, it was hard. I had people like DMing me too, being like, hey, like, is this what's going on? Or they have like different theories, and I just like, you know, respond with the zip face emoji, right? Some of them were really far off and some were actually quite close to what was actually going on. So it was hard, especially because, you know, you're writing this and I had known for so many years what was happening and what was going to happen in the last book, some of the things that they were going to discover and the revelations that were going to take place. So keeping those to myself for years, that's hard, especially since I'm the kind of person that I'm like, if I buy somebody a birthday present early, I end up giving it to them early because I can't hold on to it for that long. But it did help that I could tell a couple of my close writer friends, and I could tell my husband, because I was like, do you care about spoilers? And he said no. So I told him. So I had a couple people that I could tell. But yeah, it was tough. It was tough to keep it under wraps.
Well, I just love them. I don't think I was able to guess many of the spoilers or twists, maybe 1 or 2, but that's it. That's just a sign of a great writer, always keeping my mind guessing. And I remember when you were writing, I think it was particularly book 2, which is The Bone Shard Emperor, that you were having some difficulties writing it, from getting the plot of it right. What was more difficult about writing that book in particular?
I think it was because I just had not had any practice writing a book 2. So, you know, when you go and you try to get published, people always tell you, don't write a complete series because you don't know if that first one is going to sell. And that's good advice. So I wrote a lot of first books. So by the time I got to The Bone Shard Daughter, I, you know, had it down pretty well. Like, okay, this is what a first book looks like. This is what it feels like. I, you know, I like to read a lot of series and I like to read a lot of trilogies. So I had an idea of what the second book should look like, but I had never written one. So I definitely didn't have as much practice at that. So I did a lot of like reading too online, like about like plot structure of trilogies, what happens in them. I thought about what second books or second ones in trilogies are like movies and stuff, like what kind of feel I wanted for it. So it was really kind of hard for me to nail that down. Even though I knew what the overarching plot was going to be, it was difficult to nail down the details just because I hadn't had a lot of practice doing that.
Understood. And I could see how there's always a saying in the publishing and the author industry, like second book slump. That's just a thing going around, and you did not have that at all. So whatever the extra time you put into it and put out this series, each book builds upon the next up to the epic finale in this. So congratulations. I'm a huge fan of it.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Now, before we get into the main plot of the series, I just wanted to remind the audience that this is a deep dive episode. So the first half or so of this episode is going to be spoiler free. And then towards the second half of the episode, we're going to talk about spoilers for the whole series. But there'll be a big spoiler warning. I'm going to say it several times. So don't worry if you haven't read the series, we'll give you proper warning on that. So with that, why don't we get into the two main primary, I'll call them, characters of Lynn and Jovis. So Lynn is the daughter of the Emperor, has no memory of who she was or her childhood, and her father, the Emperor, is constantly testing her and providing, if she answers questions correctly, is giving her magical keys that can open other parts of the palace. And she's in competition with her foster sibling, I'll call him Bayan, to unlock more of these keys. So right out of the way, we have our main character, no memory, and she needs to unlock these doors in a palace and just get as much information as she can. So right away, we have the mystery and we have the hook that just nailed it for me. Talk about Lynn as a main character. How did she come to mind? And why did you want to initially give her to the audience of your books with no recollection of who she was?
So I knew pretty strongly before I started writing that I wanted to have a character who was in this palace of locked doors where she had to complete these tasks and successively unlock them and discover new things. And then of course the question arises, well, who's locking her up there? Like, why? So, you know, then it was like, well, it's a father, it's the Emperor. Why is he doing that? So it kind of progressed from there. Part of it too is like, I'm a big video game fan. I love playing video games and I love that kind of progression. You know, when you're playing Zelda, right? You're in a temple and you're trying to solve these puzzles, and each successive like tool that you get helps you unlock more puzzles, and there's like mini bosses that you have to fight before you get to the big boss. So I was thinking kind of a little bit about that as well, where I like that kind of structure because I feel like it's one of those things where it's interesting in the beginning and then it gets more and more complicated and more difficult as things go along, and you're uncovering these things that kind of lead to this conclusive hole. And in the case of like a dungeon, say, it's like you get all of those tools that you need to defeat the boss at the end. So that to me was like something that I thought was really cool and interesting, and I wanted to bring that into a book.
Well, no wonder I love this series so much. Legend of Zelda is my favorite video game series, so I always knew there was a little bit of a connection, but glad to hear that from you. And inside this palace, it's not just Lynn and her father and Bayan. There's these constructs which are powered by bone shard magic. Could you talk a little bit about the constructs, maybe how they're formed, and a little bit about the magic and how it works? And we'll get more into that on Jovis's side of the story.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when I was talking about bone shards being a basis for magic, I also knew that I wanted to have constructs. So immediately the connection there is, well, the constructs are powered by the bone shards because they need to be powered by something. And so I started researching, well, because I thought, well, they'd be powered by the life force of the people that they were taken from, which means they'd still have to be alive. So where can you take bone from somebody and leave them still alive? Well, you can take it from their skull. So that was kind of how that progressed. And also I thought about, well, constructs have to have some commands that they function under. So the commands are going to be carved onto these bone shards. So kind of, it was just like a logical progression for me to build that kind of magic system. And then besides the fact that I, you know, I read a lot of sci-fi as well. I'm a big sci-fi fan too. And, you know, the first sci-fi book that I read was iRobot by Isaac Asimov. And I love that idea of language being fallible. So you start that book and you read these three laws of robotics and you're like, well, and nothing could possibly go wrong if these robots have to follow these three laws. And then you realize as you read these short stories and you go through that book that there are all these like little loopholes or like certain specific situations that under which these laws break down. So I knew that I wanted to have these commands that, you know, because language is not airtight, that there are ways to get around it. Which is, you know, one of the things that Lynn has to figure out as she's going through this process of unlocking the doors.
Yeah, excellent. And a little bit about the Lynn's father, the Emperor, because what he's doing, it's not without a purpose. And you'll slowly figure that out as you go further into the Bone Shard Daughter. But he is under the assumption that this long-lost race called the Alanga are going to be returning. They've been extinct for centuries, let's say, probably longer than that. But he always has this fear that they're going to be returning. And he's so in his own mind about this return that he's like putting all of his resources into stopping it, where no one else believes that it's going to happen. And then the outside portions of the Emperor are fed up with him and they're debating, like revolting, starting a revolution. For the Emperor, a little bit about how he came to mind, because he's, on one hand, he's trying to protect everything that he loves. On the other side, some people think he's going insane from all these visions and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you put anybody in that kind of position of power and the pressures do get to you, especially if you are trying to do what you think is right. And then he's also got all of these secrets that he's living with that he feels he can't tell anybody else. So it's a very kind of lonely place to be. And yeah, he's not the greatest person in the world. But I do feel like at this point in this history that he's kind of cracking a little bit under that strain. And, you know, it's he very strongly believes that what he is doing is the right thing and the necessary thing in spite of all of the evils that he has to enact in order to do this thing that he believes is for the greater good of his people. So I think being in that position of power when he thinks that he's doing the best thing, and then also to have people like harrying him and harassing him, it's those kind of conditions I think would make anybody crack.
I agree. And the other primary POV character we have is Jovis. Jovis is a smuggler, and he's a wanted smuggler at that. He's searching for his long-lost love, going from island to island, trying to get more information. He arrives at one of the islands, I believe it's Deerhead Island, and then he's witnessing a festival where children, they're getting their bone shards of their bone in their skull removed for the Emperor, for the magic of the constructs. Now, one thing we didn't mention was that the bone shards also the Emperor, like, obedience from his people in his kingdom so that they won't revolt, because if the bone shards die, they will die as well. And then while he's on that island, he notices that it's starting to, the drowning empire. Can you tell me a little bit about Jovis, how he came to mind, and just the, well, we'll talk about the other companion that he finds in a little bit, but I just want to talk about Jovis for now.
Yeah, so I, you know, while I knew I wanted to have this girl that was in this palace of locked doors, I also knew that I wanted to write this smuggler character that was kind of, you know, had a heart of gold, but was like grumpy and, you know, professes like not to care about the world around him because he's very single-mindedly focused. So, you know, as an archetype, I kind of drew a little bit on like that kind of Han Solo-ish character, although, you know, he is quite different, but I knew that I wanted that kind of base to go off of. And I think he's quite humorous, although, and he thinks he's quite humorous, although the people around him do not always think so. And that to me, it was kind of fun. I wanted to write that voice of somebody that is always kind of poking fun at themselves a little bit. And is always a little bit frustrated with themselves as well. He finds himself in these situations where he's like, oh gosh, I guess I'm going to go and save this person again, even though I really don't want to. But even though deep down, he actually does want to do it. So yeah, I knew I wanted to have like a little bit of levity in there, because I think even in the darkest moments, like we all find something to joke about.
Yeah, Jovis is definitely a little bit of the reluctant hero, but kind heart, you always want to root for him. And if you're a fan of stories with animal companions, then I'm happy to announce that this is definitely the series for you. So Jovis finds this he's at sea, he finds this little creature who he ends up naming Mephi. And Mephi is just, he always puts a smile on your face with how he acts, how he eventually learns to talk, and just everything about him. I know you have a lot of cats. I wonder if Mephi was inspired by them and some other creatures you have.
Yeah, I mean, I had a cat a long time ago that ended up passing away when he was quite young. But I did think of him a lot when I wrote Mephi, where he was just like really mischievous and got into everything. But then he like snuggle with you and he'd be really sweet. And you're like, all right, you're okay, I guess. I mean, he's also just like super, super friendly. Like I'd have a party and then he'd always be like around and like making friends with everybody. And so, yeah, so I thought of him a lot and I was like, well, what if he could talk? Like what would that be like? So yeah, I mean, that for me, it's like Mephi is kind of like the ideal pet in a lot of ways, where for me personally, I like animals that are very energetic and who get into a lot of trouble. But are also like just very sweet as well. Like my old cat, like he used to unroll the toilet paper all the time, rip it up, spread it down the hallway, get into the flour in the cupboard, get that everywhere, you know. So, and he was always like stealing my guests' food, which was a little embarrassing and, you know, something unfortunately I was not able to put a stop to. But yeah, so I really like that kind of zest for life.
Yeah, Mephi is an amazing character and animal creature to follow, and him and Jovis bond, obviously it grows over the book, and we'll talk more about that in the spoiler section. Not going to get into that now. One thing we didn't discuss, and this is a big part of the story, is the two primary characters, Lynn and Jovis. You write them in the first person, while there's three secondary characters in the first book, one of them my favorite, Sand, we'll talk about that later, you write in the third person. To my knowledge, I've never seen a book or a series written quite like this. How did you come about this? And was it difficult switching from one to the other?
I'm sure there are other books out there. I think I'd heard about some, but I know for me, like I really enjoy writing. The simple explanation is I really enjoy writing in first person. I also enjoy writing in third person. But I felt like it might be a little bit much to have all of them in first person. Besides the fact that for me, like Lynn and Jovis are the two primary characters around whom the other characters kind of orbit in some ways. So I wanted to have those two be that first person perspective. And the other ones are kind of like the secondary main characters that are kind of in the orbit of Lynn and Jovis. So that's kind of how I thought of it when I was writing it. As far as switching between the two, so I'm like doing the same thing in my next series, because I have like these two characters who are also the ones that everybody else kind of orbits. And I do this a lot where I'll sit down and start writing a chapter and then realize I'm still like in whatever POV that I had used in the previous one, because I like to write chronologically. So yeah, so then I have to go back and like fix the voice and like the POV. But it's generally, I'll get the hang of it again after like a couple paragraphs. So yeah, it does like cause some issues sometimes, but not enough that I want to change what I'm doing.
No, you did a great job with it. I'm very much looking forward to what your next series has to offer with that same kind of structure. Now, the final character I want to talk about, and there's others, but don't want to take up too much time because we want to talk spoilers in a little bit, is Sand. So she is located on a far island in the Empire. She doesn't have memory either, and she's with other people on the island who have names. Basically, they do the same tasks like every day repeating, and they don't know why they're doing the same tasks. And Sand tries to get to the bottom of it. It's like, why are we here? Why are we doing the same things in the first place? And then her arc over the first book slowly grows, and then to pretty shocking revelations at the end, but that's spoiler territory. So what was the thought with this island of people with no memories doing the same tasks over and over again, and Sand in particular?
Well, so like that's some of that's going to get into spoiler territory, but on the non-spoilery version, I mean, on the simple side of things, I just like writing that kind of uneasy mystery where there are things that are occurring that on the surface seem really strange, and as the consumer of whatever media that is, you're kind of like, what is actually going on here? And the characters themselves are treating it as normal. I really, really love that kind of, it's like this sense of unease that brings forth. And also it creates this curiosity where you want to keep going because you just got to find out like, well, what is actually going on here? Like, why are they behaving this way? So that was like, that's the surface level explanation. The deeper one is more spoilery and involves like the background information of like why they're there.
Yeah, I get that. Just wanted to give a little bit of a hint to people who haven't read it yet as to what they have looking forward to. Before we wrap up the non-spoiler section, I wanted to give the audience members a chance, if you would be so kind as to share a little bit about the new series that you're working on, what you're permitted to share. I'm sure we all love to hear about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I mean, I have the first book done right now. I'm in the process of revising it. And it basically, it follows two sisters who have been separated by a cataclysmic event and who are trying to find each other again. And it's set on a hollow world, which scientifically doesn't make sense, but I'm like, haha, magic, where the gods live in the center of the world. And there's also magic that exists in the air in particles, and that becomes more and more dense the closer you get to the center of this world. So it's there's like a fun, cool new magic system where you have to like hold your breath in order to use magic, which is partially inspired by like my experiences just as a swimmer. And I've been doing like a lot of reading about like free diving and stuff. So there's that main storyline where these sisters are trying to navigate their way back to each other. And then there's some side stuff, like there's an expedition that's using experimental equipment that goes terribly wrong. So I've been doing a lot of like fun research on that. Obviously, like the whole thing that happened with a submersible recently was something that I was like, wow, that's reminding me of some of the stuff that I'm writing in my book right now. Yeah. And then there's like also like a very intensely political storyline as well. So yeah, I don't know how much more I want to, well, I can also say that a lot of it takes place in a kind of apocalyptic landscape as well. Yeah. And there's this clandestine war between the gods that's going on. So I think I'll probably like leave it there. There's probably like some better explanations I've written online as well, but yeah.
Do we have a title for the new book or not yet?
Do not have a title yet. We agreed on The Gods Below is the series name. So I did like send them along, those summaries of books two and books three. So I have that kind of, the overall arc is all planned. And it very much makes sense to be called The Gods Below, but we haven't agreed on a title for the first book yet.
Awesome. Can't wait to get my hands on that one. Well, now I think we'll wrap up the non-spoiler section. So if you haven't read the Drowning Empire series, first book being The Bone Shard Daughter, please be sure to pick it up. It's riveting. It's amazing. It's in my top 10 all-time favorite series. It's just the twists that Andrea puts in it will just shock you. I remember vividly in each book, I think there was like back-to-back-to-back three chapters where my jaw hit the ground three separate times. So you have that to look forward to. So we're going to switch over to the spoiler section of the discussion. If you haven't read the series, I believe now's the time to depart. Once again, spoilers in 3, 2, 1. Okay, here we go. So right off the bat, the first big shock was Lynn is a construct. She's not human. She has memories from her past about she was once alive, but then she's not. And also that her father, the Emperor, input memories of her dead mother into her. So she is basically her mother built into a construct. That was a wild twist, to say the least, when I found that out. How did that twist in your mind come to mind? I'm just really curious.
I'm like, how did I like, there's that whole like uneasy mystery thing too, right? Where it's like, you find out, oh, there's actually something pretty sinister going on. And I knew that the Emperor had his obsession basically with, his dead wife, where he has burned all her pictures and all the people that knew her very closely is killed. And at first you think like, oh, well, that's just because he's jealous of his memories of her. He doesn't want anybody else to have that as well. But then you kind of find out like there's these other things going on, and it's because he doesn't want anyone else to like realize that Lynn is like not his real daughter. But yeah, so it was kind of like, it started from the idea that, okay, well, I have her in this palace of locked doors. Like, why is it like this? Like, well, it's because he doesn't really trust who she is, or, you know, so then it's like, well, why? So a lot of the plot for me and a lot of these secrets and mysteries are just come from asking myself why a lot over and over again. And some of them came to me just from the very beginning, but this one was kind of like a result of just asking why, because I feel like there are a lot of things like we don't know about our world or our history that only become uncovered if you kind of dig really deep.
Yeah, and that twist, like, it just made everything just lock into place. I'm like, oh my God. So that meant this, and this meant that, and now the story is propelling forward at this rate. I was still shocked to see about that. But one of the even more shocking was when Lynn found the secret lair of her father in the basement, and she finds Thrana, and her father's doing experiments on her. I always wondered, and this, I don't know if it's explicitly said in the story, but I'm just going to ask it now. Was Thrana bonded at least one time with the Emperor's wife, and that's why she's there doing experiments?
No. So he actually just dug down in those old mines and found her because he knew what the islands were and where these creatures came from, because he's one of the only people that really does know, because all that history has been destroyed.
Got it. And so by default, then, he must know who the Ilonga really are. And
yeah, no, that's why he's so afraid, because he knows that. And that to me is like one of the themes I wanted to really touch on too, is like, we always like fear these things from outside that we think are so different from us, when really a lot of the times the things that we are fearing are just like us, or they are us. So, you know, like, so for this, like, you are led to believe that the Elanga are these people who are coming from the outside, who are very different from the people of the Empire, when really they are the people of the Empire. So, you know, like, it's, in one sense, it's like, oh, well, the call is coming from inside the house, right? But on the other hand, yeah, I was thinking a lot about that fear that people have of, like, migrants and refugees and all that. We're like, oh, they're going to come here and they're going to take our jobs or they're going to commit crimes, when it's like, you know what, they're people just like you. Like, that's really what it is that you're fearing. And is it so terrible, right? Of course, there's an added element here where they have, you know,
magic,
super magic powers, right? But that was one of the things that I was thinking about when I was writing that part.
Oh, awesome. And then the other layer of that is the Elanga are, they're the humans who have this connection with these creatures. And the other part, Jovis and Mephi, develop this magical connection as well. And they're an Elanga reborn. So, and then when Lin and Thrana meet up and then they go forth in the rest of the series, they're slowly learning more about what the Elanga are, why they became, you know, extinct so long ago. And, you know, it just kept building this lore in the story and in the background that I just constantly wanted to learn more about. And in book two, The Bone Shard Emperor, you have these, I forget the name of who wrote them, but these journal entries, like on the top of, like, of some chapters. I was wondering how did that idea come to mind, and then it led to the big revelation on the end on who actually the person who wrote those are.
Yeah, for that, I knew that I had to, like, convey this information, because I'm like, oh, like, I need to actually show what happened, like, that led to that massacre of the Elanga. And I couldn't, that was, like, the most elegant way I could think of to do it was, well, we're going to have some journal entries. They're going to be deciphering it and they're going to figure it out. Because, you know, you want your characters to do that figuring out. You don't want to just put it there for your readers, because that feels like an author insertion. So that was, like, something I had to think about for a while, like, how I was going to get that information across.
And they did a great job at it. And going full circle, we're going to come back to Sand. We're going to do the spoiler part of that little discussion on why they're on that island. Because Sand, as she's slowly remembering, she finds an actual bone shard, and through that she remembers who she was and the memories from that interaction. Her memories are of Nysong, who is the Emperor's wife, the deceased wife, and Lin's mother. That revelation completely blew me away, and what you were able to do with that. Could you go into that part of it, and then why overall the people were on that island?
Yeah, so that was, like, another thing where I was kind of just, like, following those logical conclusions. Like, I knew that the Emperor was trying to basically, like, rebuild his dead wife. And then I was like, okay, well, it's not going to really work out the first time. Obviously, this is a very complicated process. But, like, what is he going to do with these constructs that he's put her memories into? Like, is he just gonna dispose of them? And I was like, well, I don't think that he would feel okay doing that. They, like, got her memories, like, right? So I'm like, well, he's probably just gonna, like, put them off on some island somewhere, because then, like, they won't, like, bother him, but then he also wouldn't be responsible for killing them, because he's, you know, he's a little bit weird that, like that, right? So that was, like, what I was thinking, that how that worked out. Then, like, also then he's like, well, I gotta put some other people out there, because she's gonna, or her, all of these constructs that have her memories are gonna need some more support out there. So then he, like, has some other of his experiments out there as well, because he didn't start out immediately trying to put her memories into the first, like, construct that he built. He was experimenting with other people, which is something that you figure out during the course of the second book. So, yeah. And then I started thinking about, like, well, how much autonomy do these constructs have? Like, do they have autonomy beyond their beyond their commands, like, what does that mean, right? Like, I mean, that's like the questions that we ask ourselves about AI a lot too, right? Like, what, at what point does it have some free will of its own? And then I was like, gosh, like, if they do have some free will, or they discover that they have some free will, they're probably going to be pretty pissed off. So that's like how that piece kind of grew from, like, that first initial concept of him doing those experiments to, oh, they're going to be pretty mad about it.
Yeah. And once Sam realizes who the memories of who she has in her head, she becomes primarily like the main antagonist for book two, trying to, you know, build an army of her own and go after Lin at this point, who is the emperor. And then things happen, and then it kind of gets out of her hands. It becomes bigger than her, so to speak. And that was, you know, that's still probably my favorite part of book two, was like the building of that and like the ultimate battle at the end. And speaking of the end, we need to talk about the ending sequence to this whole series, because I had absolutely no idea. And once again, spoilers if you're still out here and haven't realized it by now. The islands themselves are, forgive me, I forget the names of the creatures, like what Mephi and Thrana are.
Oh, they're Ocelyn.
Oh, Ocelyn. The islands are the Ocelyn, and they grow to exorbitant sizes, and how they sink is with these swords that can cut the Whitstone from them, and then ultimately if you cut enough away, they sink. That was just insane. So they're living in this empire where islands are made up of these Ocelyn, which are part of the Alangi. So it all comes like full circle into how this whole world's talking. Is this something you knew from the beginning, or did it come?
Yeah, that was something that I knew from the beginning. I knew I wanted to write these living islands, which is why immediately from the beginning you find out that they're migratory. And I'm just allowing people to assume that they're just moving around for like just whatever reason, right? So it's not until like you get to the book three that you realize like, oh, they're migrating because they're alive. And part of that too is, you know, I wanted to have a very strong ecological theme for the books, because I feel like it doesn't make sense for them to be mining that Whitstone all the time, especially because it does like lead to their home sinking, but like, they've grown so accustomed to it and it's formed the bedrock of their trade that they can't seem to get away from it. And I feel like, I know there's like, it's maybe like a very in your face kind of parallel with what we're kind of doing, but I just feel like that's just kind of where we're at as well, where we're just continually destroying the place that we live on. And it's like a little bit horrifying that this is happening. And then of course we have like refugees who are coming from climate ravaged countries, which is something that happens throughout the book, where refugees are having to be placed on other islands and not everybody is like happy about it, but they're doing it to themselves, right? So like, that's like, so I knew from the beginning, yeah, like this is what's going to happen. And well, how do they grow from babies, right? What happens there? And also like, well, this is where all their magic comes from. So you find out through the course of the series that all of the magic that you think is like all very separate, there's like, oh, you're like, well, there's two different kinds of magic systems. Like, it's all bone magic when it comes down to it.
Yeah. It's, I still can't get over it. And the ultimate finale, well, there's many different facets of it, but one, it's a redemption arc for Sand. And I love that little ending you had for her. And then Lin and Jovis, how Jovis loses his memory on everything. Him and Lin became very close. They're actually lovers, and they lost that. And Mephi won't leave him for a second because he wants to be there for him when and if he remembers. And it's not till many years later, when Lin is actually on the island of Thrana, That's how big she's actually grown. When Jovis comes back and saying, I don't know who you are. I don't know what we had in the past, but I keep having this recurring dream that I loved you and I want to try something again. So it was just such a touching and sweet ending to it. It was just beautiful. I absolutely love that part of it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, like with Sand, I knew I wanted to write a redemption arc. I really felt for the things that she had been through, but she had also done really terrible things. And I feel like I see it so often where in redemption arcs, the person that is being redeemed, like redeems themselves by dying, right? Which is like, I feel like that can still be done well, but I feel like dying is so simple and I like stuff to be messy. And I feel like if you were to truly try to redeem yourself, like there's a difference between redemption and forgiveness. And I don't think that people have to forgive you for you to redeem yourself. And I wanted her to have to do that hard work where people they have the right to their anger and they have the right to not forgive her because she's done terrible things. But I wanted her to at least try to start making things right. So that's kind of like where that came from. I knew that that's how I wanted her story to end, where she's changed her ways and she's trying to make things right, but it's hard. And that's, you know, that's life, right?
Right.
Yeah. Like forgiveness is not a prize that you get at the end. And with Jovis, like for me, that seemed like, first off, like I like a bittersweet ending. I like things, like I said, to be messy. It's not a neat, pretty tied up with a bow ending. And from where he started, where he's just this very, like you said, like reluctant hero, and he's just not, he's being very selfish in some ways. or he goes to doing this completely selfless thing because he's like always been struggling with this idea of like what is a hero. So first, like he's like, I don't want to be a hero. Second book is, I do want to be a hero. I do want to be a hero. And then third book is, what does that mean? Right? Like, if I do bad things, am I still a hero? So and for people in general, I feel like things are so complicated that we all try to do the good things, or at least I hope we do. But we end up doing things that are maybe not so good just because the world is so complicated. So what does that make you then? Does it make you heroic or does it make you terrible? So so that was something like I knew like I wanted him to have to deal with. And you know, there's a cost. So yeah, it was very sad for me to write all that, especially like, you know, I think it's so funny that people are always asking me like, you know, does Muffy die? Does he make it out okay? And I'm like, telling everybody, well, he doesn't die. But he suffers a lot of like emotional trauma, which to me is like sadder than dying. As I've said, I feel like dying in a lot of ways is simple. You leave and you're gone and that chapter is closed. it's the people that are left behind that are truly the ones who suffer, right?
Yeah, in the series, it goes through the emotional gambit of everything you just discussed. It's one of the reasons why I love it. You left the ending a little bit open. Is there any thoughts that maybe sometime in the future of revisiting this world?
Yeah, I mean, maybe someday. So, you know, obviously, like they don't find all of the swords. Like they're still out. There's quite a few still out there. They've come to this resolution on their government where they're like, okay, we are going to try like a council. We are going to try government by the people. and if I did ever return, it would probably be very many years down the line when they've worked out some more stuff with their magic, when their government has come to a point where it no longer meets their needs because things have changed in their society. And I would return like when things had changed for them, because I feel like one of the things that I'm really interested in addressing is the idea that government should be a little bit flexible because things do tend to change. So if I did revisit it, it would be that inflection point where this government that they built, that has worked for them for so long, is maybe not working in the way that they intended anymore because so many things have changed. And I feel like that's kind of ripe for conflict. So that to me is like something really interesting, just because I look at our government right now and there are so many little pieces of it that are kind of like feeling that stress because so many things have changed since the time that it was instituted. So yeah. But there's that reluctance to change things because they have worked for so long. And also we kind of put the founding fathers on a pedestal and everything. Like, anyways, I don't want to like get too into politics, but like I do find that point, that inflection point, really interesting.
Great. Any thought to maybe like a prequel about when the Elango were at the prime of their power?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I would have to really think about if there was a conflict that I would be interested in visiting, just because prequels are hard for me because I just don't feel like there's a lot of new or interesting ground for me personally to cover. I think that prequels can be done really well and I do enjoy a good prequel. For me though, like a lot of the interest of discovery is gone. so I don't know. Maybe someday that'll change.
Well, whatever you want to bring out in this world, I'm a fan as always. So just let us know. Happy to give it a go. Well, Andre, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much again for joining me. Before we sign off, why don't you tell the audience members where they could find you, your website, your Twitter handle, and when, quote unquote, we should be expecting to see your next work.
Yeah, sure. So I'm basically Andrea G. Stewart everywhere. So it's andreagstewart.com is my website, and Andrea G. Stewart is my username on Twitter, on Instagram, and sadly, I have dragged my withered carcass onto TikTok. So I'm on TikTok now as well. And as far as the next book, that will be coming out sometime fall 2024.
Amazing. Can't wait to read that. Well, Andrea, this has been lovely. Thank you again so much. And hopefully we get to do this again sometime with your new series.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Blaze. It was so great being here.
Cheers, everybody.